Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the assassination of Iran's leading nuclear scientist, which followed a secret meeting in Saudi Arabia between Secretary of State Pompeo, the Saudi Crown Prince MBS, Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the head of Mossad, Yossi Cohen. David Hurst, the editor of the Middle East Eye, joins us from London to discuss his latest article, exclusive, Saudi Crown Prince was reluctant to back US attack on Iran, and how the hawkish Netanyahu and the cynically ambitious Pompeo were not able to get MBS to agree to a wider conflict with Iran, apparently settling on the hit on the Iranian physicist. We'll assess the broader strategy of forging an alliance between Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and Israel, which could end up making Israel the gateway to the Mediterranean and Europe for Gulf oil and gas exports, which will mean throwing the Saudi ally Egypt under the bus by bypassing the Suez Canal. Then we'll look further into the possible repercussions from the hit on the Iranian scientist, which Iran's supreme leader has vowed to avenge. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was a high-ranking member of the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, who Netanyahu had singled out by name in 2018, and we will speak with the founder of the IRGC, Dr. Mohsen Sazagara, who held several high-ranking positions during the early years of the Iranian Revolution, including serving as Deputy Prime Minister in Political Affairs. He joins us to discuss Israel's determination to stop Iran from getting a nuclear bomb now that Mossad fears the Iranians are about 3 months away from having two nuclear bombs after enriching enough U-235 fissile uranium following the collapse of the P5+1 nuclear agreement, which Trump and Pompeo scuttled. Then finally, we'll go to the battleground state of Georgia, where control of the U.S. Senate will be decided in two January the 5th runoff elections, which are being fiercely contested with Democrats and Republicans pouring in money and resources. Jeffrey Lazarus, a professor of political science at Georgia State University, joins us to discuss Trump's vilification of Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, who he called an enemy of the people, and Trump's upcoming visit to the state next Saturday to repair the damage of his own rhetoric as he tries to encourage Republicans to vote in an election he has called rigged. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now from London is David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, who was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian, The Guardian's former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, European correspondent, and Ireland correspondent. And his latest article at Middle East Eye is exclusive, Saudi Crown Prince reluctant to back U.S. attack on Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Hurst.
Hello, Ian. Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us, David. And you have quite a story on your hands here. And it's interesting that there's been a lot of reporting on the secret trip that Netanyahu took along with the head of Mossad to this Saudi city that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is building, Neom, I guess. But the part that's missing is the fact that Secretary of State Pompeo was at that meeting, and I believe he put it together, didn't he? Didn't he organize that meeting?
Yes, very much so. I mean, according to this information is coming basically from my sources who are in basically the Saudi royal court. And what sort of information they're providing me is the sort of inside information on the discussions that are taking place between the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his senior advisors. And from that, one could get a picture that the Saudi Crown Prince has been bullied by America in the dying days of the Trump administration to normalize relations with Israel. Now, personally, he really doesn't have a cell in his body that is sympathetic to the Palestinians and would do so immediately. However, his position is weaker than it was as the de facto ruler, and he realizes how much domestic pressure there is on him not to do that. So he's very reluctant. And all the statements about Israel, Saudi Arabia's relationship with Israel, all the public statements haven't actually been in his mouth. They've been in his father's mouth. And his father stuck to the old line, the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative, which basically says that, which is the Saudi creation as well, by the way. This was by his predecessor, King Abdullah, which basically says Saudi's only going to recognize Israel after a deal has been done and after a Palestinian state has been set up and after the Palestinians themselves have agreed. That's the standard line, which this whole wave of normalizations has actually disrupted and broken. So Saudi Arabia is going to stick to that, and Mohammed bin Salman can't really do that much. However, he has a real problem, and the problem is the arrival of Joe Biden, or rather the withdrawal of his two protectors, two best protectors, which are Donald Trump and Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. They're the people that basically have been covering up for Mohammed bin Salman. They are the ones who held his back when he's been accused of killing Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi journalist. And they're the ones that have been basically holding line. They're just about to disappear. And Biden has made no secret of the fact that he wants to hold Mohammed bin Salman accountable. Now, by this time, Mohammed bin Salman wanted to be king, but he's weaker than he was before. He's much more troubled. The war in Yemen is costing him an absolute fortune. His allies in the Emirates aren't helping him either, because they've got the south and they've got what they wanted, the ports, whatever. But they've left him with the Houthis and the real war. So that's not going well. The economy is not going well. And he's just about to lose his two greatest, most effective protectors. So that's the background to the meeting at Nome. It's a meeting he didn't really want to have, actually.
Well, it looks as if there was the strike on the Iranian nuclear site and Roshan Fakhrizadeh, was that kind of a compromise? In other words, the U.S. didn't commit to full military support. Apparently, Netanyahu was hawkish at the meeting, and as you point out, MBS was reluctant because he knows that if we do anything against Iran, they'll wipe out his oil facilities as they did. Well, they didn't wipe it out, but they sent a very strong message a while back when they hit Abqaiq. So is the killing of the nuclear scientist a kind of compromise that came out of that meeting?
Well, here I'm speculating. I don't know. I'm guessing. But it would seem to me that for the second time in about a month, Trump has hit a dead wall with the idea of a parting shot that would have the great advantage from Trump's point of view of messing up Joe Biden's Middle East presidency, his policy, before he's even got his feet on the ground in the Oval Office. That was a really big incentive for Donald Trump, because he thinks personally, and he thinks like that. He doesn't think about the Middle East. He thinks about himself and losing to Joe Biden. But the military were against it. The only people who were for it was, of course, a very hawkish Benjamin Netanyahu. But what really put the spoke in the works was Saudi Arabia, because, as you say, they've been hit once. These are all messages passed by Iran. And then there have been two more recent attacks on Saudi oil installations. One of them was a missile strike launched by the Houthis on Aramco's plant in North Jeddah, which is quite a way in past the border. And then a limpet mine attack on a Greek-owned tanker in the Red Sea port of Shukaik. So, again, very calibrated messages to say, if you go down this path and we get hit by the full force of America's non-nuclear might and its air force, then you're going to pay the price. And it's just too much for him. He doesn't want that. He really, really doesn't want his oil facilities going up in flames because he needs them so much. And so he's backed off that. As I reported from my Saudi sources, Pompeo was non-committal. The Iranians still regard, and also the Saudis, by the way, still regard, still to this day, regard a threat of an attack as very alive. So they don't think the threat has actually gone away. And then suddenly out of the blue, the night before last, you get this assassination attack, which is the fifth assassination of a nuclear scientist in 10 years. So one way of interpreting this, but it is just guesswork, is that this is option B for Netanyahu, will hit their top nuclear scientist and that's it, before this policy reverses itself. Interestingly and significantly, John Brennan, who was the CIA director under Barack Obama, said this was a criminal act. And he produced a very strong tweet for someone who was director of the CIA. He said, it risks lethal retaliation, a new round of regional conflict. I don't know whether a foreign government authorized or carried out the murder. He said, well, obviously that's a hint that Israel did. But for Brennan to kick up as much as he did about hitting another high-ranking Iranian general is significant. And that shows the way that people who are close to Biden are thinking about this.
And again, I'm speaking with David Hurst, who is in London. He's the editor of Middle East Eye, and his latest article at Middle East Eye is exclusive, Saudi Crown Prince Reluctant to Back U.S. Attack on Iran. So we don't know what kind of promises Pompeo made in this secret meeting with Netanyahu and the Saudi Crown Prince in this city that the Saudi Crown Prince is putting together in the desert. There was, of course, I think about 2 to 3 weeks ago, Thursday, there was a meeting in the White House at which President Trump asked, I don't quite know how to put it, but he apparently wanted to attack Iran, and he was supposedly talked out of it by Netanyahu, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Vice President Pence. But it's hard to believe, David, that if Netanyahu said, I'm going to go ahead and kill their top nuclear scientist or do something provocative, that the U.S. wouldn't have made the promise, well, if things get out of hand, we'll have your back. I mean, that's the bottom line, isn't it, with the U.S. relationship with Israel?
I think it is, yes. And I think the Iranians know this. But the next question to ask, really, is what will the Iranian reaction be? And despite what they said yesterday on Saturday, that they would avenge this death, I think that with Biden so close to power and to the policy of Iran, particularly sanctions, that's what their real aim is, to reduce the sanction regime, the maximum pressure regime on Iran, that they will adopt and they will stick to their policy of strategic patience or strategic restraint. This is what they did for Soleimani, who was a higher-ranking general who was killed in a drone strike on official business as he basically got off a plane in Baghdad. And I think this is what they will carry on and do now. There, of course, is also, we've got to factor in Iranian elections next year and the possible successor to Khamenei, the supreme leader. And if you think, for instance, of what happened with Qasem Soleimani, he was killed, if you remember, in a car as he was getting out of his airplane, along with al-Muhandis, the engineer, who was a Shia militia leader. And at that time, it was the Shia militias that began reprisals and have been carrying on reprisals against American troops in Iraq. And interestingly, just before these events, we reported exclusively that a senior Iranian general turned up in Baghdad and told the Iraqi Shia militias to calm down and cease their attacks on the Americans in the run-up to Biden and the transition and transfer of power. So on the one hand, Iran sends a direct message, a threat, to Riyadh and says, look, if there's an attack on us, you'll pay for it. On the other hand, they're restraining their proxies in Iraq, where the Americans are very visible and very vulnerable, and they have lots of troops on the ground. So that shows you the Iranian thinking. And I don't think, I could be wrong, I don't think that this will spark an immediate counterstrike, although they'll certainly remember it and try to strike back at Israeli generals when they travel.
Well, Iran's President Rouhani has said in response to the killing of the nuclear scientists, in due time, they will, I guess referring to the Israelis, they will answer for this crime. And earlier he had said Iran is too wise to fall into Israel's trap. But Netanyahu is being provocative, obviously, and Iran's ace up their sleeve in terms of deterrence with Israel is that Hezbollah can rain rockets down on Haifa. So then, of course, God knows what kind of retaliation the Israelis would if one of their major cities was damaged or destroyed. So this thing could spiral out of control. What do you make of Trump's efforts to cut the troop strength in Iraq in half? Does that tie into this, or is Trump just being Trump because he obviously wants to pull out of NATO and do all kinds of reckless things to salt the earth for Biden?
I think one of the effects or one of the consequences of the blowback from the Soleimani killing was it was under a previous Iraqi prime minister, Abdel Mahdi, but there was a resolution in the Iraqi parliament, and that was backed up by statements by the then prime minister that all American troops should leave Iraq. I don't think that's going to happen, primarily because America has a very big base in the western provinces, the Sunni provinces of Iraq, and that also services troops amongst the oil fields in protecting the oil fields in northeastern Syria. I don't think that's going to happen, but they're certainly going to reduce their presence because they're very vulnerable. And that's a long-term aim. At the moment, we've got another prime minister, Kadhimi, who's doing a very delicate balancing act between the Americans and the Iranians. By the way, no friend of the Shia militias, and particularly Kataib Hezbollah, because they accuse him of setting up the murder, which he denies, of al-Mohandis, because he was then the security chief. And they basically say this drone attack could not have happened without his knowledge. He claims he didn't know anything about it. So he's in a delicate position as well. I mean, basically, I think on Trump and the Middle East in general, it's been a disaster, a much bigger disaster, and it's left the Middle East far more unstable than before. And you can see the instability because this new alliance that they've created between Israel, the Emirates, Saudi, look how unstable the whole thing is. This is what the Middle East would be run. These are the guys that would be running the Middle East if they continued like this. Now, one of the biggest partners now dropped out, Trump, and Biden has some sort of opportunity to reset this and make it a slightly more stable by talking to Iran, by reducing the sanctions regime, by getting back to treaties. And Israel, what's Netanyahu's incentive? Basically, to make hay while the sun shines or continues to shine. He knows the sun will shine a little less brightly with Biden. And therefore, he's just basically getting in as much work as he can, not just on Iran, but on settlements and on hitting at will Iranian targets in Syria before Biden comes along and puts a brake on all of this.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, a broader look, though, at the region in terms of resource extraction and getting them to market, since they're oil and gas-rich countries we're talking about. Many analysts think that one of the reasons why Putin got into Syria was to block the possibility of Qatari and Emirati gas in particular being a competitor to Russian gas in Europe. I understand that the Jared Kushner, Trump, MBS, Netanyahu plan, of course, basically they're trying to change the subject from the Arab-Israeli conflict into the Arab-Iranian conflict. But aren't they also trying to open up Israel as the Mediterranean access to particularly gas and oil coming from Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis through Saudi Arabia, through Jordan, into Israel and into the Mediterranean? Is that a long-term plan?
Absolutely. And that plan is destabilizing their own camp and their own allies. If you're in Abdel Fattah Sisi's position, i.e. president of Egypt, and you're not getting any more money from the people who sponsored your military coup, the Saudis and the Emiratis, are getting far less than you did before, and your economy is going south anyway, and you've invested all this money in the Suez Canal, you're looking at all these, the oil pipeline. Google announced a fiber optic cable. There's talk of a high-speed link between the Red Sea and between Israel. And you're saying, what is going on here? Because we're being cut out. So this is a very, very unstable plan, because it's actually cutting out one of the largest countries that is strategically on their side. The Egyptians are absolutely on the side of the Saudis and also the Israelis, and against Turkey and Qatar and Iran. So this is a major ally, and it's just basically appalled at what's going on. And of course, there's huge amounts of money involved in this, and huge potential riches to make Israel a gateway. I mean, in theory, the top foreign policy analysts for Biden have been a little bit lukewarm about recognition of Israel in the way it's happened. They are formally for it, but they basically say, well, what's the point, since they weren't at war in the first place? And they say that it can't be a substitute for real talks with the Palestinians. So Biden won't oppose recognition of Israel, but nor will he promote it as strongly as Jared Kushner and Donald Trump did. So what's happening with the fault lines of the Middle East is that they're moving from the level of protest groups, subnational groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamists, to the level of states. You've got actual blocks of countries who are dealing with each other. America's retreating generally, and has been retreating over at least two presidencies, and pivoting towards repositioning towards China and the Pacific Basin. And what you've got is a sort of 19th century fight between regional powers, and that is Turkey, Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, Qatar, and a long way down the line, of course, comes Egypt, because it's so weak. And it's very unstable, extremely unstable. So, but this is a small taste of how unstable the Middle East would look like if really the Saudis and the Emiratis and Israel was in a driving seat.
And apparently, just in closing, David, apparently Pompeo told the Crown Prince in the secret meeting that once Biden's in, all you've got is the Israel lobby and the Republican control of the Senate.
Yes, he did. And that's why Bin Salman is such a nervous character these days. I don't think that Biden is going to disrupt the relationship with the kingdom or with the king. There's just too many things going on between America and Saudi Arabia to do that. But that doesn't mean he's going to support what is a crown prince and nothing more to become king. He's got elder brothers. He's got very, very aggrieved uncle. He's got an even more aggrieved cousin. All of them are more senior and better known to America and to the CIA than he is, although he's now fairly well known to everyone. He's not guaranteed. So what's happened, what of power, which is what the whole thing has been about. He killed his rivals. He tortured people. He shook them down because of power and to get absolute control of his country. So that's not good news for him, because he's becoming much more vulnerable to a Paris coup that he himself engineered. And we don't know what's going to happen. He could become king, but what the result of his nervousness is, he's had to lean on his father, who's in not a terribly great mental state with dementia, and use his father as a protector, because he knows that he would not have that protection and that loyalty without his father being alive. So it's gone from, shall I force my father to abdicate, to, I need him more than ever before, and I can't rule without him.
Well, I'm not going to shed too many tears for him, David, but I thank you very, very much for joining us here today.
Okay. Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Hurst, who's the editor of Middle East Eye. He was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian and The Guardian's former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow Bureau chief, European correspondent and Ireland correspondent. And his latest article, Middle East Eye, is exclusive, Saudi Crown Prince reluctant to back U.S. attack on Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking further into the possible repercussions from the hit on the Iranian bomb maker. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Mohsen Sazegara, who's an Iranian journalist and pro-democracy political activist, who was a founder of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and held several high-ranking positions during the early year of the Iranian Revolution. He served as Deputy Prime Minister in Political Affairs, Deputy Minister for Heavy Industry, and Deputy Chairman of the Budget and Planning Department. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mohsen Sazegara.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the top Iranian nuclear scientist who was killed and the government of Iran is blaming it on the Israelis, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, did you happen to know him at all?
No, I don't know him personally, but I know that he was 63 years old. He was a member of IRGC and he was picked by Hassan Moghaddam, who was head of the missile project of Iran about 20 years ago for military nuclear project of Iran, which is quite separate from the peaceful nuclear projects of Iran. And it's not under control of Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. It's under IRGC, Revolutionary Guard, and very secret project. I think that he was targeted, not now, for several years. His name was famous because of his position as secret head of the military nuclear project of Iran. And several times, the inspector of International Atomic Energy Agency that, you know, traveled to Iran, asked to meet him, but never succeeded to visit him and talk to him. And Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, mentioned his name 2 years ago, and he was in the list of sanctions, international sanctions. So I think that especially Israelis were looking for him, and at last assassinated him in 60 kilometers away from Tehran, in one of the suburbs of Tehran. And he's the seventh person amongst the scientists and the managers of military nuclear project of Iran who has been assassinated in Iran during recent years.
The seventh, you said, right?
Yeah.
So, and again, of course, you mentioned Israeli Prime Minister back in 2018 in a press conference where he displayed what he said was evidence of the Iran secret nuclear program. He mentioned Fakhrizadeh's name and said, urge people to remember that name. And it does seem, from what I've learned from David Hurst of the Middle East Eye, he's got very good Saudi sources, that the meeting that took place, the secret meeting that took place in Nome, the city that Mohammed bin Salman is building in the desert, the recent meeting, the secret meeting with MBS and with Prime Minister Netanyahu and the head of Mossad, Yossi Cohen, also at that meeting was Secretary of State Pompeo. So they all got together just very recently in a secret meeting. And in this, it looks as if this assassination came out of that meeting, but it seems like Mohammed bin Salman is afraid to provoke Iran, even though Israel wants to provoke Iran. And We don't know what position Pompeo took in that secret meeting. I mean, obviously, at this point, Iran is being very restrained. And Prime Minister Rouhani has said, you know, that we don't want to fall into Israel's trap. So give me your sense of what you know about what's going through the mind of Iranian leaders, but also there's two governments there, right? The Rouhani government, and then there's the Revolutionary Guards and the Supreme Leader. So if you could tell us what you think is going on in both of those camps.
It's a big question. You know, first of all, I have to say that in Iran, the government and so-called president who is at the head of executive power is nobody with respect to the leader. These types of problems or subjects are controlled by the leader himself. According to the constitution, armed forces, intelligence, judiciary power, the exclusive national radio and television, Council of Guardians, and several key organizations of Iran are controlled by the leader. He's in charge of the key policies of the country that the executive power should follow. And he's the guy, I mean, the leader who make decision in these regards, especially, for instance, the nuclear issue. I say that because I have heard that somebody in Washington say that, okay, Rouhani is moderate and maybe radicals come to the power, so hurry up to make deal with them. My knowledge and my experience says that it's a cliche and wrong assessments. These types of decisions are under control, exclusively under control of the leader. And
you're talking about Ayatollah Khamenei, right?
Yeah, Ayatollah Khamenei is the leader of Iran, and he's the type of manager that goes to every detail and controls lots of details. But this is the type of his management that he doesn't take any responsibility. He prefers that in the window shop, other people act, but he has all the strings and control everything. This is my first part of answer. But the on the other side, that's a big question, that what was the subject of meeting of Netanyahu and the MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, with Pompeo in Saudi Arabia? And what subject was so important that they couldn't meet even on in Corona era on internet? They had to meet face to face. There are many gestures and many propositions comes to the mind that what was the subject. I have heard did Pompeo urged Saudi Arabia, like the other Arab states, to start normalization of relationship with Israel, and they didn't accept. Still, they emphasize on their precondition, which is Fahad project, and they say that Israel should fulfill those plans, and then they will be ready to normalize their relationship. But this is not something new. It can't be the only reason of such a meeting. The other guess is that, yes, Israel actually informed Saudis about their actions against nuclear project of Iran, which is now in the red zone. According to Israelis, they say that escape point in JCPOA was 1 year, but Iran has violated, and now the distance of Iran to nuclear bomb is less than 3 months. And Israel doesn't tolerate that and will act against Iran military nuclear project, not only assassination of the people like Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, but they may have military strike against nuclear centers of Iran, nuclear sites of Iran. Some of them are very famous, like Natanz or Fordo, but there are some other underground sites of nuclear project of Iran that we don't know that, but definitely Israelis know that, because about a year ago, they took about 500 kilogram documents from Tehran and announced it, or several other sources that they have. So it might be the subject of such a high-ranking meeting might be the actions, military strikes of Israel against the nuclear sites of Iran in very near future. I don't know when.
Well, 3 months is a pretty short time frame. So my understanding, Motion, is that Iran has plans for a working bomb that was the Pakistani version of a Chinese bomb that was sold to them by AQ Khan. And they think they've got enough enriched uranium to make U-235 for about two bombs. That's my understanding. And also, you know, if Israel's about to strike within 3 months before they can put the fuel in the bomb, that would mean, I don't know that they have the ability unless they use nuclear weapons. And the U.S. has been doing exercises in the Gulf with B-52s, which can carry these bunker-busting bombs. So it seems like this secret meeting that took place in Saudi Arabia with Mohammed bin Salman, Netanyahu, the head of Mossad, and U.S. Secretary of State Pompeo might have been discussing, you know, this further military option. Because if you keep striking Iran and killing their people, at a certain point, surely the Revolutionary Guard Corps just can't restrain themselves and maintain their discipline. And once there's retaliation, then that will escalate. Isn't that the likely scenario?
Again, I repeat that if they want to retaliate, whatever Israelis do, even this assassination in Tehran, it's up to decision of the leader. IRGC can't do anything without his order. This is not like that, because I have heard that some people say that they may do something by themselves. That's not true. They have such a discipline that they should obey the chief commander of armed forces of Iran, which is the leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. If Israel strikes against the nuclear sites of Iran, question, does Iran, IRGC, or Army of Iran, or whatever, retaliate? There are not so much options for them right now. For instance, one of the options is that Hezbollah in Lebanon has been equipped with several missiles. Can Iran ask Hezbollah or order Hezbollah to attack to Israel? I don't think that Hezbollah is in a position that can do that because of internal affairs in Lebanon. And especially, we have noticed that U.S. sanctions against Iran has tightened the hands of regime because they don't have money. About $70 billion Iran reserves are blocked, and only about $6 to $7 billion can be used by Iran just for food and drugs, according to the orders of the U.S. to all banks in the world. And they don't have enough money to pay to Hezbollah or to Hamas or Jihad Islami inside Israel or other terrorist organizations like Houthis in Yemen. This is the first problem of the regime of Tehran. The second one is that the U.S. is in the region. If, for instance, they decide to send some missiles toward Israel, definitely Israel will retaliate. This is the manner of Israel that responds to any attack several times more than that. And then what? Then, you know, Iran, if wants to continue and escalate the tension between Tehran and Tel Aviv, then the U.S. forces are in the region. They are in Persian Gulf, and they have lots of facilities. Very recently, about a week ago, two B-52 airplanes were sent to the region as well, besides to all other facilities that U.S. has over there. Nimitz has returned to Persian Gulf during these days. I mean, options for Tehran is very limited. I don't say that they don't retaliate, because they should do something to say to the people of Iran that we are powerful and we retaliate whatever Israel does. But when I think about the options that they have, I find out that they don't have such an open hand to do whatever they want.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, President Rouhani has said in due time, they, the Israelis, will answer for this crime. So that may just be bluster. You're saying that he doesn't matter, Rouhani, and he never has. The real power is with the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. Yeah. So what do you know about his personality? I know he has medical problems, and his son is angling, and he's with the Revolutionary Guard Corps, his son is angling to take over. And what kind of mindset does he have? Because he's obviously, he considers himself, you know, God's messenger on earth, doesn't he?
You know, Khamenei is a pragmatist. During last 32 years that he has been at the leadership of the country, head of the country, we have seen in several scenes that whatever he says doesn't matter. In reality, when he wants to do something, he is very cautious and have somehow realistic image of the real power. For instance, they definitely, he knows, and his top advisors, that they don't have any strategic balance with the U.S. or with the Air Force of Israel, for instance, or even Saudi Arabia Air Force or United Arab Emirates. This is the reason that they have put lots of money and investment in missile project, because Air Force of Iran is somehow obsolete and is very old-fashioned and has no functionality in this era. I mean, I have seen already, for instance, in the case of Qasem Soleimani, who was his right hand, when he was killed by the U.S. forces, they already informed the U.S. through some other countries and sent some missiles to a U.S. base, but they made sure first that there is nobody in the yard to be damaged or killed, and tried to control the crisis, not to escalate it, because they knew that if something happens, U.S. may attack to them and they can't confront that. I mean, I think that in the case of Israel, the Khamenei will behave the same. And I don't want to say that he's a coward too, but I prefer to say that he's realistic enough not to push the country toward a war between Iran and Israel, especially that the U.S. backs Israel in the region and Saudi Arabia is against Iran and other states all around Iran.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. And obviously, if Israel decides, if they've only got 3 months before Iran gets a bomb and they won't allow Iran to get a bomb, then something could happen very soon. And even though you just said that the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, may be restrained in his response, it would be hard to see that given how inflammatory it would be to the Iranian people. So I thank you for joining us, Dr. Mohsen Sazegar.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Mohsen Sazegar, who's an Iranian journalist and pro-democracy political activist, who was a founder of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and held several high-ranking positions during the early years of the Iranian Revolution, serving as Deputy Prime Minister in Political Affairs, Deputy Minister for Heavy Industry, and Deputy Chairman of the Budget and Planning Department. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Trump can repair the damage of his own rhetoric as he tries to encourage Republicans in Georgia to vote in an election he has called rigged.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through. just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jeffrey Lazarus, who's a professor of political science at Georgia State University, whose research focuses on Congress's members' strategic behavior, both as candidates and as legislators. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Lazarus.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And obviously, all eyes are on Georgia at the moment, and they will be all the way through till the runoff election on January the 5th, and President Trump will be holding a rally in Georgia next Saturday, December the 5th. And there's a rally apparently Saturday with Kelly Loeffler, one of the candidates running, one of the incumbents, I guess, and the guy that helped defeat her, the Republican who ran against her, allowing Reverend Warnock to win, was rallying with her. But what's your sense on the ground there? Because there's been a real problem that Trump has had by sort of creating this myth that the election was stolen and it's all about fraud. A lot of Republican voters who believe Trump, and that 77% of the 73 million that voted for him, there's a lot of people, they feel that way. And now Trump's worried, and the Republicans are worried, that a lot of discouraged Republicans aren't going to show up. So now he's trying to do damage control. So what's it like on the ground there now?
Well, there's a lot of political activity in Georgia. I mean, control of the Senate is at stake with these two runoff elections. And so the entire nation is focused for the next month and a half on Georgia. So every interest group, every political donor, every volunteer is trying to influence these two races. And so voters here are getting nonstop ads. We're getting mailers. We're getting texts. About the only thing I haven't seen is a lot of door-to-door canvassing, which is cut down due to the COVID pandemic. But aside from that, every form of political activity you can think of is happening in spades here in Georgia.
And what's being done by both the Republicans and the Democrats to get people to register for this election? You have to register by December the 7th, apparently. Even if you voted in the last election, you've got to re-register to vote in this. Is that the rule?
No, that is not true at all. If you are registered to vote, you are registered more or less permanently, unless something really unlikely happens. So if you're already registered to vote, you don't have to register again. The only people who need to register are people who had not registered to vote prior to the November election.
I see. And that would be what, younger college kids, right?
Correct. So primarily people who are turning 18 in between the November election and the runoff are the ones who have to register.
I see. So that's not a significant vote. But again, Biden only won the state by a little more than 12,000 votes. So it's going to be close. I'm asking you to be a handicapper now. Who do you think's got the advantage, the Republican incumbents or the Democratic challengers?
In my opinion, the Republican incumbents have the advantage because Georgia is pretty reliably a very closely divided, but closely divided Republican state. In the past 20 years, a lot of Republican incumbents and other candidates have won with about 52 or 53%, which makes the state look very close. But, you know, year after year, Republicans have won with those thin margins. What makes the race more interesting is that for the first time in 20 years, a Democratic presidential candidate carried the state. That's Joe Biden in this most recent election, like you mentioned. And so that's given Democrats a shot in the arm, making it look like it's more possible this year than it has been at any time in the recent past that a Senate candidate might get over that 50% hump.
Well, it seems, though, I mentioned that Republican voters may be discouraged, and Trump is now being made aware of that by his friend that runs Newsmax, and Trump has sort of had to revamp his message and say to his supporters in Georgia, we must get out and help David and Kelly, two great people. And again, as I say, he's showing up next Saturday, December the 5th, to campaign. Although campaigning with COVID, I don't know how many people he's going to get to risk their lives to do that. It seems that what's been happening is that you better believe that Mitch McConnell desperately wants to win those two seats to maintain control of the Senate. And my understanding is that basically Trump has been sulking and he's basically didn't want to do any campaigning. So I think the leverage that Trump has over McConnell is, okay, I'll campaign for you if you will continue to believe my ridiculous notion that I won the election and it was stolen from me. And so far, McConnell has not, even though he's supposedly a friend of Joe Biden's, he has not accepted Joe Biden as the president-elect. So what do you think's going on there between those two men?
I think you're right. I think there's a lot that's going on. Donald Trump has not given any indication throughout the 4 years of his presidency that he cares about anything except Donald Trump. So it's not clear that he even cares whether the Republican Party holds the Senate when he's not in office anymore. As you said, he's going to come down here and campaign for the two candidates. He most likely is doing that as an opportunity to continue his national messaging strategy, trying to convince people that the election was stolen from him, which, in my opinion, is he's largely doing as a fundraising effort and also to try to boost his prospects for a possible 2024 run, either for himself or for one of his children. As for the relationship between Trump and McConnell, absolutely, McConnell wants these two seats. He wants to continue to be majority leader of the Senate. I don't think McConnell needs any convincing to go along with Trump's stolen election narrative. McConnell himself has shown that he is a party actor more than anything else, all the way back to 2008 when he famously declared that his number one goal was to make Barack Obama a one-term president. So, you know, Mitch McConnell is going to do what is best for the Republican Party come hell or high water. And right now he sees that as number one, trying to win these two races, and number two, supporting Trump in his stolen election fantasy, because that is going to be what excites Republican voters, not just in this runoff election or in these two runoff elections, but also beyond in 2022 and also for fundraising purposes between now and then.
But does it excite voters to say that the last election was rigged and therefore the system is corrupt? And by the way, Trump went out of his way to go after the Secretary of State of Georgia, a Republican, yep, who's behaved, I think, very admirably. He called him an enemy of the people. So yeah, on the one hand, he's more or less, I mean, how do you encourage people to vote in an election you say is going to be rigged against you? What kind of message is that?
It's a really fine line. And Raffensperger, the Secretary of State in Georgia, even said that there's some evidence that a significant number of Republican voters were discouraged, that there are some 20,000 Republican voters who voted in the primary in Georgia but did not vote in the general election. And it's entirely possible, in fact, almost certain, that if all 20,000 of them had voted and nothing else changed, that Republican would Donald Trump would have won Georgia. So I think you're absolutely right that there are at least some Republican voters who are discouraged from voting, who think that Trump is right and everything is rigged and it's not even worth going to the polls. Now, it's not a huge number of voters in a state where, I don't know off the top of my head how many voters there are here, but when in a state where several million voters go to the polls, 20,000 is not a huge percentage. That being said, in a close enough election, any advantage or disadvantage might be decisive. So you're right that if, you know, Trump keeps pushing this stolen election narrative, that it could prove the difference between a close election between one of the Democrats and one of the Republicans.
Well, but just do the math. 20,000 Republicans who voted in the primary who didn't vote in the general. Had they voted, Biden only won by 12,000. Trump would have won Georgia. So,
yeah. I mean, I hesitate to draw any really strong conclusions because I don't know, for example, how many Democrats voted in the primary and didn't vote in the general. So once you start going into the weeds on these counterfactual situations, it's really hard to game out what would have happened. But it's certainly possible or even plausible that Trump cost himself Georgia.
So let's talk a little bit just in closing about the candidates then. Your sense is that it's going to be an uphill battle for Raphael Warnock, the Reverend, who is the pastor at Martin Luther King's famous Ebenezer Baptist Church, and the documentary filmmaker John Ossoff. Already, of course, I'm sure there's a racial subtext because Warnock is black, and I understand there's even been some sort of anti-Semitic suggestions because Ossoff is Jewish. What can these two do to win? What's your sense of how post-racial Georgia is? Because, you know, the black candidate who ran against Lindsey Graham got more money than God. I mean, he had so much money to spend, and he lost. And yeah. Many people think it's because he was black. So give us your sort of reading on where things are in terms of both a black candidate and a Jewish candidate running against two very white, establishment, wealthy Republicans.
Right. Well, so the number one factor that influences elections more than any other is still party. At the end of the day, the reason that I say Loeffler and Perdue have an advantage is because more Republican voters live in the state of Georgia than Democratic voters. And that's a tough hill to climb for any Democratic candidate. So before we even get to, you know, discussions of the fact that Warnock is black or Ossoff is Jewish, you have to account for the fact that, you know, any Democrat is going to have an uphill climb. On top of that, you know, you use the phrase post-racial, and I don't think that Georgia or the United States at all is post-racial. Race is still very much in the mix and in some ways at the forefront of a lot of the discussions that we're having, not just with Warnock, but in terms of the difference between the Democratic and the Republican parties more generally. Warnock, very interestingly, just released a television advertisement that was just 30 seconds of him walking his dog in a very bright, sunny neighborhood with picket fences. And it was just him smiling. And it tried to make him appear as harmless and unthreatening as could possibly be. And, you know, that was a very deliberate decision by the Warnock campaign to release an ad like that because, you know, in many ways, you know, African-American candidates have to overcome the perception that they are somehow threatening or menacing or, you know, conform to a lot of racial stereotypes. So the Warnock campaign has to, you know, tiptoe around these associations that a lot of people have with African-Americans and black politicians more generally. And these are concerns that, you know, Kelly Loeffler obviously doesn't have to deal with. So that's another consideration. In terms of the other race, John Ossoff has not, to my knowledge, really discussed his Judaism or made it a theme. That being said, David Perdue has, in a couple of subtle but very real ways, alluded to Ossoff's Jewishness in his advertisements or his speeches, and in ways that are pretty negative and could be described pretty accurately as anti-Semitic. So to the extent that those messages resonate with voters, you know, David Perdue is probably doing that very deliberately. Will that give him an advantage? Who knows? I don't know if enough voters hold these negative associations with Jews for it to actually help Perdue, but it is something he's been called out for over the course of the campaign, not just in the runoff, but in the original campaign as well.
And of course, Ossoff in the original campaign called him to his face a crook in a television debate, and Perdue never really responded, did he? And he's canceled all of the debates, and obviously doesn't want to debate him again. So that's where we're at. Let's stay in touch, Jeffrey, because clearly, as I mentioned from the beginning, all eyes are on Georgia, and they will be for the next 6 weeks.
Yeah, I'd like that.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Lazarus, a professor of political science at Georgia State University, whose research focuses on members of Congress's strategic behavior, both as candidates and as legislators. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.